I'm pleased to introduce our second keynote speaker, Glenn Greenwald, who is a former constitutional and civil rights litigator and current contributing writer and columnist at The Guardian. He is the author of 3 New York Times best-selling books, 2 on the Bush administration's executive power and foreign policy abuses, and his 2011 book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, an indictment of America's two-tiered system of justice. And it strikes me that maybe the New York Times bestseller list needs a third category these days. They have fiction, they have nonfiction, maybe they need anti-fiction. Greenwald was named by The Atlantic as one of the 25 most influential political commentators in the nation, and by Newsweek as one of the country's top 10 online political opinion writers. He is the recipient of the first annual I.F. Stone Award for Independent Journalism, the winner of the 2010 Online Journalism Association Award for his investigative work on the arrest and oppressive detention of Bradley Manning, and a finalist for the 2010 National Magazine Award for Excellence in Online Reporting and Commentary. And we have him here, not online, but in person. Please welcome Glenn Greenwald.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming out this afternoon, and thank you as well to the conference organizers for inviting me here to speak. I speak at a lot of events, and it's actually truly inspiring to be at an event organized by a group that was born out of a desire not merely to voice grievances, but to organize against them. We need a lot more of that, and it's really great to be part of an event that is dedicated to that goal. And it's also really great to be part of an event that is grounded in the recognition of how important it is to build coalitions based on the premise that every group in the United States that is engaged in activism against the government, to check the government, and that especially is vulnerable to majoritarian oppression has an equal stake in civil liberties and civil rights and is equally affected when any one group has their rights abridged. That is a crucial precept for understanding the danger of the civil liberties assault in the United States. Now, I write a lot about civil liberties. I speak a lot about civil liberties. The title of the conference that we're here to convene for is a civil liberties conference. And so there's a lot of different ways to talk about this term civil liberties. It's a pretty complex area. There's a lot of different approaches one can take. But one of the things that I think is so crucial to do whenever I write about civil liberties or talk about civil liberties in an event like this is to take a few minutes and ask the question, what is it that we even mean by the term civil liberties? What is it that that denotes? And the reason I think that's so important is because it's a term that gets tossed around a lot. You hear politicians of all stripes all the time invoking this concept. It's pretty much a cliche at this point. Nobody debates civil liberties. No one ever stands up and says, I just want you to know that my position on civil liberties is that I'm against it. It's something that it's just a slogan designed to justify whatever anyone wants to justify. And so it's important to really understand the definition of what this term is. And the good thing about that endeavor, about understanding what the term civil liberties actually is that it is not a very complicated concept. It's actually fairly straightforward. When we describe civil liberties or talk about defending our core liberties or our constitutional rights, all we really are referring to is the list of prohibitions, the list of limitations that we have imposed on the government regarding how they can exercise their power against us. It is a list that we've imposed on them and said, you can never cross these lines if we're to accept the assertion of your authority as legitimate and valid. And the further good thing about that endeavor, about understanding what the term civil liberties means, is that we don't have to go out on a sort of scavenger hunt in search of this list of limitations that we've imposed on the government's power. That list is found, it has been assembled all in one place, which is called the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And the best thing about this endeavor, about understanding what civil liberties means, is that this list of prohibitions, the limitations that we've imposed on the state, are not ambiguous or muddled. nor are they circumstantial or conditional. They don't apply only in times of peace or whenever it can't be demonstrated that national security would be aided by their violation. They are clear and absolute and unconditional. And the way that you know that is simply by looking at the list and seeing what it says. So if you look at the First Amendment, it says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. If you look at the Fourth Amendment, it says, nobody shall be subjected to unreasonable searches and seizures without a probable cause warrant, a warrant issued upon a finding of probable cause. If you look at the Fifth Amendment, it says, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. They are absolute in their expressions. They're unconditional in their application. I once had this fairly acrimonious exchange with Joe Klein of Time Magazine. I've actually had many acrimonious exchanges with Joe Klein of Time Magazine, but this one in particular that I'm thinking of took place in 2008 or 2009, and it was an argument about civil liberties. I don't recall the specifics, but it went on for a couple of weeks, and it became very kind of confrontational, and it involved the exchange of lots of accusatory statements. And in the middle of it, he wrote something and said, I think what's driving all of this, the key thing to realize about why this dispute has arisen is that Glenn Greenwald is a civil liberties extremist. And honestly, what happened was when I read that statement by him, I was actually really bewildered because I thought to myself, you know, I don't understand this. We're having this extremely vituperative exchange. We're saying all sorts of horrible things about each other. And all of a sudden in the middle, he just stopped and decided to lavish this incredible praise on me. Like, I'm a civil liberties extremist. And it took me a few minutes. Then I realized, oh, wait, actually, no. When he says that, he actually means that that's like a bad thing. And the reason that was so confusing to me was because civil liberties extremist is, in essence, the greatest compliment that someone can pay you. And the reason I say that is because there is no way to defend liberties without being extreme about it. There is no way to express fealty to these rights that I just described without insisting upon their application to everyone equally and in all circumstances. The minute you start justifying pragmatic waivers of them or exceptions to be made for pragmatic considerations is the minute that you cease to believe in them. And what I think is so critical about this concept of civil liberties and the specific expressions of it that it finds in our Bill of Rights, in our Constitution, is that if you look at the state of the United States, and you've heard about this all day, including from Professor Aziz just now, what you find are not isolated case-by-case violations of them. What you find are fundamental and systematic repudiations of these rights. So if you look at the history over the last decade of the way in which American Muslims have been prosecuted for, quote, material support for terrorism, what you find is that they've been targeted and prosecuted based not on acts that they've undertaken, but on beliefs that they've expressed. If you look at the sprawling surveillance state that has been erected, in which all of our activities are monitored and recorded and stored in government databases without any indication that we've done anything wrong, let alone a showing of probable cause that we have, it is as complete and pure a violation of the Fourth Amendment as it gets. And if you look at the system of indefinite detention, of putting people in cages, often for life, without even a pretense of any charge, or what we have now, which is targeting people, including American citizens, for execution, for extrajudicial assassination, in total secrecy, without charges, oversight of any kind, that is as profound and complete a repudiation of the Fifth Amendment's guarantee against the deprivation of life or liberty without due process of law. This is a systematic violation of these liberties, not isolated case-by-case basis. And what's most striking about it to me is that as we move further away from the precipitating pretext, which is the attack of 9/11, what one finds is that these violations become more acute. They continue to increase rather than recede. And so what I want to do is just spend a few minutes asking two questions about this state of affairs. One of which is, why has this happened? Why has it been allowed to happen with relatively little backlash and resistance of the type that we've convened here today to generate? And secondly, what are the primary implications of allowing these sorts of abuses to continue in such a fundamental way for as long as we've allowed them to continue? And the reason I think those two questions are so crucial is because only by understanding what causes it and understanding why it's so crucial to stop it, can we ourselves begin to think about how to create strategies for arresting it and convincing our fellow citizens to join us in that effort. So let me begin with that first question, which is, why has this all happened? Why have we allowed this to happen? And I think there are a few reasons why this has taken place and why it's been so difficult to combat it. What are the impediments? The first of which is that all of this is taking place in the context of war. And not just a war against a specific country, but a war against multiple countries on the planet. The reason that's so significant is because it is always the case, historically in every society it is the case, that in times of war, that is when the power of political leaders is most unconstrained. 2,000 years ago, Cicero said, "When men pick up arms, the law falls mute." There are no limits, or very few limits, that can be effectively applied to political leaders when they're prosecuting and waging a war. That was why it was supposed to be so difficult under the Constitution for wars to be commenced, because of the threat that they pose to our core liberties. And what's most amazing about the quote-unquote war which we're currently fighting is that, unlike prior wars in American history that have justified civil liberties abuses, which ended when those wars ended, so Abraham Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus ended when the Civil War did. Franklin Roosevelt's internment of Japanese Americans, they were liberated once World War II was over. This war, by design, can have no end. It is designed to be an internal and permanent war. Just 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post reported that the Obama administration is in the process of codifying its quote-unquote kill lists by creating what the administration is calling a disposition matrix. A matrix that analyzes algorithms to determine how you should be disposed of. Should you be put into prison indefinitely without charges? Should you be killed? Should you be charged with a crime? And the premise of this system, said the Washington Post, was that Obama administration officials are acting on the premise that the quote-unquote war on terror will take place for at least another decade, which means that it will have lasted longer than 20 years. And when you talk about a war that lasts for 20 years, you're no longer talking about a finite, discrete event that ushers in civil liberties abridgments that end when the wars do. You're talking about a fundamental and radical transformation of the kind of government we have. The other aspect of war that makes it so difficult to combat civil liberties abridgments is that one of the crucial strategies of war on the part of every government is to dehumanize the group against whom violence is being applied. And the reason that's so crucial is because no population, other than the most sociopathic, would tolerate years and years and years of continuous lethal force applied to a foreign population unless the humanity of that population has been obscured and hidden and denied, unless they've become dehumanized. And this war has involved the lethal application of force against almost exclusively one group of people, which are Muslims. And although the government and its officials will explicitly say that we're not at war against Muslims generally or against Islam, the theory, which is that every time the U.S. government imprisons somebody without charges or kills somebody, that it should be assumed, without evidence being presented, without due process being afforded, that those people somehow deserve it, that they're militants or terrorists or whatever other labels the government and the media slap upon them reflexively, the theory has created the idea in the minds of the population by design that this group of people, American Muslims, or Muslims generally, are collectively guilty, that they're really not human in the way that we would object if any other group of human beings were being treated in this manner. And this dual approach of war, heightening the power of political leaders at the same time dehumanizing the group which is targeted, makes it very difficult to combat rights abridgments because of the idea that anything the government does in its name is probably justified. The second reason why this is so difficult to combat and why this has been allowed to happen is related to the first. Professor Aziz talked a lot about this. Other speakers today have as well. So I'm just going to touch upon it. It is the idea that because these abuses are only happening to one small marginalized group of people, that there really is no reason for most other people to be concerned about it, that you can be indifferent to it or even supportive of it. And I think, you know, it's easy to mock that idea. It's easy to condemn other people for thinking that because these rights abuses aren't affecting them, that they can somehow forget about it or be even supportive of it. But I think it's important to recognize just how potent of a strategy that is, how it can affect all of us, including people who are otherwise sympathetic to these issues. So I know lots of people who will read the things I write, who read about these injustices, who will say, look, I agree with you, these things are horrible. But deep in their minds, they know that when they wake up tomorrow morning, because they're not Muslim, because they're white, that it is extremely unlikely that they're going to be abducted and taken to Guantanamo or put in a cage without charges. They know it's extremely unlikely that a drone will be sent over their house with a cruise missile launched that blows up their house and their children. So it's very easy to deprioritize these issues, even if we think they're injustices, and to believe that they don't really require as much urgency as others that might affect us more directly. And aside from the obvious moral reason that I think nobody in this room needs to know, the sign, the motto of the conference is, an injury to one is an injury to all, aside from that moral precept, which is incredibly compelling, it is the case that it is just incredibly misguided to think in that way from a practical or pragmatic standpoint, because it is always the case, not sometimes, not usually, but always the case, that civil liberties abridgments, abuses of core rights, extend beyond their original application to all sorts of unanticipated groups. And you can look at the history of the Patriot Act over the last 10 years, which has been applied overwhelmingly in 85% of the cases to matters having nothing to do with terrorism. Or you look at the FBI strategy of creating their own plots and financing their own plots and luring people into their own plots and then at the last minute heroically breaking up their own plots and then announcing to the world how grateful we should be that they've kept us safe and yet again broken up their own plot. That tactic is now being applied to anarchist activists, to people protesting NATO policies, to, as Professor Aziz said, to the Occupy movement. And what we see most of all, and I think most perniciously of all, is the importation of war on terror tactics from what was once confined to foreign soil into domestic soil. So if you listen to U.S. national security officials who 10 years ago and 8 years ago and even 5 years ago were saying that the greatest threat to American national security was Al-Qaeda, what they now say is that the greatest threat to national security are what they call, quote, homegrown terrorists. And so you see the civil liberties abuses of the last several years being directed not outward to foreign nationals, but inward domestically to American citizens. That's what the dilution of Miranda rights are about for people taken in on and arrested on U.S. soil. It's what the NDAA is designed to do, which is to codify the power of indefinite detention on U.S. soil. It's what the paramilitarization of our local and state police forces based on tactics perfected in Baghdad is designed to do. It's what the increasingly rapid importation of drones is all about. Drones are coming to the United States. They are already in use for surveillance capabilities in numerous American cities by numerous local police departments. It is inevitable that they will spread not just for surveillance, but also for weaponized purposes. You see this importation of what was once something we could convince ourselves was confined to foreign soil, increasingly into domestic soil, and finding ways to convince our fellow citizens that we all have an equal stake in combating these abridgments is, in my view, of the highest priority in terms of combating them. Earlier, there was a speaker who was an official with the Electric Union, John Woodruff, who spoke, and I wish everyone could hear what he said, not just in this room, but everywhere, because he talked about how civil liberties abridgments are a core issue for the labor movement. And the reason that he gave was that any organization that wants to agitate against those in power has an equal stake in protecting these liberties, is equally endangered when they're assaulted. That's true not just of the labor movement, but of every single political activist group that is trying to accomplish change in the United States. That is what civil liberties is about. It's why an abridgment for one person is abridgment for everyone. The third reason that I think it's so difficult to combat these things and has been so hard, and the reason why we've been allowing it to happen, is because of the role that partisan allegiance plays in all of this. Professor Aziz talked about the fear-mongering campaign that has been incredibly effective, but so too is the role that partisan loyalty has. There's this incredible report, which you can find online, which I would urge you to go read. It's a 2008 report that was prepared by the CIA at the height of the general election between John McCain and Barack Obama. And what prompted the CIA report that was written in secret and ultimately leaked to WikiLeaks, which published it, was the concern that anti-war sentiment was spreading in Western Europe, and it had actually caused the fall of two Western European governments that were supportive of the war in Afghanistan, and the CIA was petrified that if this anti-war sentiment continued to spread, it would compel the withdrawal of troops from every government in Western Europe, and ultimately it would spread to the United States. And what this report concluded was that the only real weapon against the spreading anti-war sentiment, the only tool that could really be a good, effective antidote would be the election of Barack Obama. And the reason, said the CIA report, why that would happen was because if Obama was elected, it would replace, as the face of American wars, this swaggering evangelical cowboy that the world had come to hate, and replace it with a much softer, more sophisticated, educated, urbane, progressive, constitutional lawyer that would then transform huge numbers of war opponents into people who view these wars as humanitarian. And that CIA report was incredibly prescient, not just in terms of being able to sustain support for American militarism, but also to ensure that even greater amounts of support for this rights assault was prevalent in the United States. And I know this from my own experience. I've been speaking about civil liberties now in the United States for, 6 or 7 years. And if I spoke 4 or 5 years ago to a room like this and you just assembled 100 people randomly from the street and I stood up and I denounced all the policies that I've just denounced and I talked about the civil liberties issues I've just spoken about, you would have half of that room of randomly assembled Americans 4 years ago extremely antagonistic to what I was saying, completely hating me. Those were called Republicans. Because they were very supportive of these policies because they were George Bush and Dick Cheney's policies, but you would have 50% of the room thinking exactly the opposite way. They'd be boisterously cheering me, saying that I was defending everything that was sacred and about America, I was defending American values, fighting against right-wing radicalism. Those were called Democrats. So you had this incredibly divisive citizenry surrounding these issues. 4 years later, if you assemble that same audience and I stand up and I speak about the same exact policies in the same exact way, you'll have 85% of that room hating me, 80% if I'm lucky, and 15 to 20% of the room being supportive because huge numbers of Democrats have now become supportive of the very policies that 4 years ago they were denouncing as right-wing radicalism because it's now a Democratic president. And just to illustrate this point in a very visceral way, think about what the real controversies were of the Bush administration that caused huge numbers of Democrats and progressives and even American liberals to run around shrieking about the war that was being waged on the Constitution. It was things like the president's asserted authority to eavesdrop on our conversation without judicial review, or even to detain people without charges. Those kind of controversies almost seem quaint at this point, given that we now have a president who decrees the right not simply to eavesdrop on our conversations without warrants, though he does do that, or to simply detain people without charges, though he does that as well, but who actually signed into law a bill that codified that power of indefinite detention permanently, and who claims the right not simply to eavesdrop on us or to detain us without judicial review, but to target us for assassination. A power that he not only claims in theory, but has exercised in practice when he killed the American Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki by a CIA drone, and then 2 weeks later killed his 16-year-old American-born son, Abdul Rahman, despite no evidence of any wrongdoing. And yet the same people who were so vitriolic 4 years ago about more tepid civil rights abridgments under George Bush are, for the most part, relatively silent and quiet because there's no longer partisan opportunism to be had from objecting to these issues. And that, too, is a critical impediment to what makes these issues so difficult to fight against. Now, the last issue I want to raise about what I think the impediments are, and then I want to just move on briefly to talk about the implications and what can be done, is the way in which radicalism in the United States becomes normalized so quickly. This was something that really got underscored for me very viscerally. I just want to share this personal anecdote. About a year ago, I went and I spoke at a university in Indiana, at Purdue University, and I spoke about civil liberties of Britain in the United States, and there were three or four high school students from Kentucky who drove several hours to come and hear me speak, and afterwards they interviewed me, and they actually, although it was ostensibly supposed to be an interview, the things they said to me have stuck with me much more than I think the things I said to them stuck with them. And one of the things this young lady said, who was 15 years old and a sophomore in high school, she said, look, you keep talking about and writing about the way in which our society has changed so radically in the aftermath of 9/11, all of these liberties that have been lost. But she said, you know, for people who are my age, I'm 15, I was 4 years old at the time of 9/11. There really is no such thing as a pre-9/11 and a post-9/11 world. The post-9/11 world is the totality of their political consciousness. What seems extremist to people who witnessed the transformation has become very quickly normalized for increasing numbers of people. And as every year goes by, more and more people are trained to view it as the normal state of affairs, as something that they, with the idea of fighting against it, would not even occur to them. And that's true not just in terms of these legal issues, but the way we think about Muslims, the way we think about our fellow citizens, the powers that we think the government should have in terms of doing whatever it wants. Each day that goes by that we allow this to linger, the more difficult it is to combat it. So I just want to close by talking about what I think is the biggest implication of this, and really the primary reason why I work on these issues as much as I do, and why I think it's so urgent to get other people to work on them and band together and fight them as well. There are all kinds of implications that we could spend the rest of the day talking about, from allowing the government to punish people for speech, or engaging in massive surveillance, or depriving people of core liberties without due process. Those are all critically important. But I think the really most significant implication is one that's a little bit more difficult to apprehend, but probably the most insidious, and it's this. When you allow the government to transgress the limits that we collectively have imposed on its power, what it really does is it fundamentally alters the relationship between the citizenry and the government. So in a free society, the ideal state is that those who wield political power have a healthy fear of those over whom they exercise their power. They fear what will happen if power is abused. But in a tyranny, by definition, this is true of every tyranny on the planet, those who are citizens fear their own government. They fear the people over whom power is exercised. And the reason for that is because they know that there are no limits to what the government can do to them, because those limits are so easily ignored. I just want to share to close a personal anecdote, again, that underscored for me that theory, but in a very visceral and emotional way that has really stuck with me and shaped so much of how I think about these things. This took place in January of 2010. January 2010 was the first time that I ever wrote about the organization WikiLeaks. I've written a lot about them in the last 2 years. I've written lots of in defense, but this was the first time I had ever written about them. And in January 2010, almost nobody had heard of WikiLeaks. It was before they had done any of their really big news-making leaks. And the way that I came to learn about WikiLeaks was that in 2008, the Pentagon had prepared a top-secret report. And in this report, it decreed WikiLeaks to be an enemy of the state. It said WikiLeaks posed a grave threat to the national security of the United States, and it plotted all sorts of ways to destroy WikiLeaks. And ironically enough, this top secret report got leaked to WikiLeaks, which then published it on its website. And the New York Times wrote this very short article about it, about how this strange, obscure transparency group had been decreed to be an enemy of the state by the Pentagon, and the Pentagon was preparing to destroy it. And I just, by accident, stumbled into this short New York Times article. And I remember, after I read it, thinking, you know, look, any group that has been decreed to be an enemy of the state by the Pentagon and that the Pentagon is actively plotting to destroy is a group that merits a lot more attention and probably a whole bunch of support. And so I went and I researched WikiLeaks, and I saw that they had done all sorts of amazing transparency projects all throughout the world, and I wrote a long article about the promise that I thought this transparency model held for bringing transparency to the national security state, and I interviewed the group's founder, Julian Assange, and posted the interview, and at the end of that article, I encouraged people to go and donate money to WikiLeaks, and I gave links to how they could do that through PayPal, by Bankwire, to donate money electronically to WikiLeaks. Because I knew that they had budgetary constraints, they were sitting on lots of big secrets, but they couldn't process them, and so I encouraged people to donate. And in response to that article, I had huge numbers of people, dozens and dozens of people, in all kinds of venues, in the comment section to that article, by email to me, at events like this, basically say something to me along the lines of, you know, look, I completely understand what you're saying about WikiLeaks. I understand why you want to be supportive of it. I want to donate money to WikiLeaks. But my problem is that I'm actually afraid that if I do so, if I send the money electronically, I'm going to end up on a government list somewhere. Or even worse, can be subjected to criminal liability for materially supporting a terrorist organization. And these were not crazy, irrational people prone to conspiracy theories and wild speculation. Believe me, I can recognize people easily like that from lots of interaction. These were very sober, rational people who were petrified of their own government, who had relinquished their own rights voluntarily because their government had signaled to them that there was nothing they couldn't do to them no matter what the Constitution said. And the reason why that struck me so profoundly is because you can offer all the rights you want on a piece of paper or a piece of parchment, but if you sufficiently intimidate the citizenry out of exercising those rights by signaling to them that those who wield power can do so without limits, those rights become completely worthless. And it's actually a more effective form of tyranny than overtly denying the rights, because people who are paralyzed that way by fear can simply convince themselves that they're not being deprived of anything. Rosa Luxemburg, the socialist activist, said once that he who does not move does not notice his chains. He who does not move does not notice his chains. It's very easy to intimidate people into paralysis while convincing them that they're free. And that, to me, is the state of affairs that has arisen in the United States from this climate of fear that comes from allowing these civil liberties abridgments to take place. So the last thing I want to leave you with, because I'm out of time, and I just want to leave you with this briefly, is, you know, it's possible that if you gather together at a conference like this and you talk about all the formidable injustices that are arising and all the strong and powerful forces behind it, there's this danger that you can sort of spread this kind of gloominess, you know, like, oh my God, I've just listened to all these people talk about all these horrible rights abridgments, and I think I want to go hide under my bed or throw myself off a bridge or something. And the reason why it's so important not to think that way, and it's why it's important for, I think, everyone to think about not just what's wrong, but also what can be done about it, is because if there's any lesson that we should be able to learn from recent history or past history, it's that that kind of defeatism is completely ill-advised. The Arab Spring showed that even the most deprived populations can subvert even the most entrenched tyrannies. The history of the United States, for all of its violence and tyranny and rights abridgments, is one of individual groups targeted with the worst kinds of prosecution, banding together and not hoping that their rights are given to them, but demanding and claiming those rights. What all of these events really teach is that any structure that is built by human beings, no matter how formidable or invulnerable it seems, can always be torn down and replaced by other human beings if the right strategies are found in the right passion devoted to it. And that's what this conference is about, is finding those strategies and tapping into that passion. And that's why I'm so delighted to be with you here today to speak. And thank you again for listening.